With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
Good Tuesday morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. Reaction continues to the court decision that halted the use of pesticides on public and private property by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. The ruling was made early last week, and AgNet West's Brian German talked with an industry leader about that ruling. There are serious implications here, not just for the citrus industry, but it will be especially impactful to them as they continue to fight against an invasive pest that, as of right now, is continuing to spread through backyard citrus. So that's where we're going to start today's news. Here's Brian German.
A Sacramento County Superior Court judge issued an injunction to suspend spraying pesticides on vegetation in parks, school properties, and homeowners' backyards. President and CEO of Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, explained what this means for combating pests.
This is devastating. A lot of exotic invasive pests get brought in from other countries and other states by homeowners. And if you look, for example, with the Asian citrus psyllid, which has been found throughout Los Angeles in a lot of homeowners' backyards, if we can't go in there and control it, it's going to spread like wildfire. And while we're doing everything we can in the ag community to control these things, if we can't control it there, then we're going to have a huge problem, maybe one that's irreversible. And if anybody wants to see the devastation, go over to Florida and see what happens when you can't control it. So it's devastating. And hopefully this is going to be challenged.
Isom noted the importance of these types of pesticide applications.
You know, it doesn't get on a lot of people's radar screen because it's not a problem until it's a problem. But I know a lot in the ag community are talking about this with the potential problem that it could be. You know, many of our exotic pests that have come in just that way that I described. And so you've got to be proactive. You've got to get on this. You've got to be able to do the trapping. And if you find a problem, then you've got to be able to go in and do those concentrated spraying. You know, obviously, they're using safe materials in a safe manner. They wouldn't do it otherwise. And so this is a complete overreaction.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
And a reminder that this will be talked about heavily at the California Citrus Mutual's Citrus Showcase, which is on Thursday in Visalia. Brian and I will both be there at the event and we'll get reaction. Almond trees have had a rough go of it this bloom with unseasonably cold temperatures, but UC Cooperative Extension crop advisor David Dahl said we need to see how the rest of bloom goes before we can say how bad that damage is. Besides the fact that trees only set 20% of their flowers, Dahl said they can compensate for loss and have a cold defense mechanism.
And this has a lot to do with the carbohydrate reserves in the tree and how they're going to be redirected to the flowers that are surviving in contrast to the ones that have been killed by the freeze. So the other aspect of this is that the tree has a gradual opening of these flowers. So when conditions are good, you tend to see a very fast progression through bloom. When conditions are poor or cold, you see a very long stretched out flowering period or bloom period. And this is essentially just a survival strategy to make sure that these trees can set nuts. So that freeze event may happen at day 3, but if bloom is 14 days and you have another 11 days of flowers that are available to open up and be fertilized. So that's what makes it very difficult to know the exact damage. It's because we're only setting the minority percentage of the flowers we're seeing, as well as you tend to have this general progression through bloom.
At the beginning of bloom, there was talk of all of the varieties blooming together, but Dahl said the cold weather has changed things quite a bit.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of talk that we were heading into a flash bloom with the warm weather that we had. And as we all observed, the opposite has happened. We're seeing now this flowering period extend into its third week for the most part in some areas. And that's due to those cooler temperatures slowing down the progression through flowering.
Reports over the weekend confirmed what some analysts speculated would happen after President Trump announced new metal tariffs last Thursday. The European Union acknowledged the move and announced a potential counterstrike. The changes are a new 25% tariff on steel and 10% on aluminum. European Commission President said that will directly affect EU exports and told Politico that it'll, quote, bring forward in the next few days a proposal for WTO-compatible countermeasures against the U.S. The World Trade Organization Administration also expressed its concerns, warning of a possible start to a trade war. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters reported Trump didn't specify in the announcement which country the tariffs would apply to. However, it did trigger an outcry from U.S. allies like Canada, of course the European Union, Mexico, and Australia, as well as China, the world's biggest steel supplier. Trump has already shown he's not afraid of retaliatory measures. The U.S. saw backlash from China with newly imposed solar panel duties. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue reiterated that tough bargaining tactic when it happened, acknowledging that his industry tends to see the impact first, but backed the move with negotiations.
We just need to be very careful at how we handle the ag economy because, as you know, agriculture typically is the point of the spear of retaliatory measures. We cannot be responsible for China's reaction. Obviously, the administration knows that we've got to be prepared for that, and we've advocated on behalf of the ag economy to be prepared for any kind of situation that may arise on actions they may take.
Trump tweeted over the weekend that he is standing by the new tariffs, and they would only come down if a fair North American free trade agreement came to fruition. USDA's Gary Crawford has more on those negotiations.
The seventh round of talks to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement is almost over now. News from the meeting so far sparse, but in a phone hookup with reporters Friday, Undersecretary of Agriculture Ted McKinney said he thinks a new NAFTA will eventually be created.
And it may not be tomorrow. I suspect we'll have to see a delay of some sort through the Mexican elections. But I remain of the view that we will end up with a positive relationship, a positive deal that I think overall benefits all three countries.
Those Mexican presidential elections will be held July 1st, but again, Ted McKinney says,
I remain optimistic that we're going to get there with our colleagues.
He says Mexico, the U.S., and Canada are too important to each other to let the NAFTA negotiations fail. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up.
This is California Farm Bureau Federation President Jamie Johansson, and you're listening to AgNet West Radio Network.
Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now.
The Yisrael Family Urban Farm in Sacramento is working to educate community members on the value of agricultural production. Kanok Yisrael is the founder of the family farm. He taught himself the necessities of growing food in an urban environment and has been working to spread that knowledge. Yisrael talked about some of the community outreach that they do on the farm.
Of course, we grow. We have farm stands. We also build gardens in people's yards. We built about 40 gardens in people's yards in the last 2 years, right in our regular neighborhood. We also, my wife, she does cooking. So she teaches cooking classes, very simple ways to take food and turn it into a meal, just like grandma used to do. You know, because there's no need to learn how to grow food if you don't know how to cook it. And that's one of the reasons why even with food access, putting the food there is one thing, but if people don't know what to do with kale or don't know what to do with sweet potatoes or don't know what to do with squash because they've never cooked it before, then the food just sits there.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, while talks continue on many trade fronts, the U.S. Meat Export Federation continues efforts behind the scenes to build trade of U.S. meat products in other countries around the world. And according to USMEF President Dan Hallstrom, one reason why is consumers in other countries really want U.S. meat.
Oh, they really do, yeah. So telling our story is important, too. I mean, in a lot of cases, a lot of these developing countries, it's about just getting a supply because they don't have a lot else to eat. But when you get beyond that level, then there is an appreciation for the safety aspects, our production system. So we're telling our story. We're doing seminars. We're working with the trade in these, be it Peru, be it Colombia, be it Honduras, Guatemala, and Central America, another area that uses a lot of these products, telling our story about the safety aspects and then the nutritional and merchandising aspects. We're not even talking about promotion at this point. We're talking about education. And then in the end, at the very end of all this work, you start to see the benefits through promotion, which is the part a lot of people see. But yeah, there's a lot of this behind-the-scenes work that's going on all the time on behalf of U.S. producers.
And that's basically what you're there for.
Exactly. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, we have a gold star reputation when it comes to the integrity of our production systems and the safety and the quality. So in some aspects, it's fairly easy to market that because we do have the Gold Star reputation. When something has a USDA inspection seal on it, that's worth a lot versus some of our global competition.
Yes, really, bottom line to all this, efforts continue at all time to get into more and more countries, but with some of our mainstay countries, we got to keep up the status there, too.
Exactly, yeah. Our mainstay markets, you know, Mexico, Korea, Japan, Canada, and now the in the case of beef, China's emerging, and Hong Kong's always been a good market. We need to maintain and grow those markets as well. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we've got some entirely new regions, like Indonesia on beef, Africa on beef and pork. These are regions that are relatively new, that are starting to take more and more volume, that someday could be large markets. So that's the other thing we're working on as an industry.
Again, that was USMEF President Dan Hallstrom. You can learn more on their website. That's usmef.org. And speaking of trade, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative last week said it plans to ask for a 3-year extension of trade promotion authority in order to negotiate new trade deals. Robert Lighthizer said those discussions could be with Japan, Vietnam, or other members of the Trans-Pacific Partnership if they're interested. Politico is quoting Lighthizer as saying the Trump administration will aggressively negotiate trade deals designed to benefit all Americans. He spoke during an introduction to the USTR's report on its annual trade agenda. The office intends to ask Congress to extend the president's trade promotion authority, also known as fast-tracked authority, to obtain an up or down vote on new trade agreements submitted to Congress. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
You know, it's hard to understand what's going on with NAFTA. Mexican farmers, Canadian farmers, and American farmers want to keep it strong and stable. Our Secretary of Agriculture himself said that the loss of NAFTA could have tragic consequences for all of agriculture. And he's a farmer himself. It isn't that the administration wants to dump NAFTA. They're looking for ways to improve it. But most of the problem is that fruits and vegetables don't seem to fare well for U.S. farmers, while Mexico is charged with dumping some of the same products on American and Canadian markets. Everybody knows that U.S. farm products are important to the whole world, so the administration needs to listen to farmers and farm leaders before changing NAFTA. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, Agnet West.
This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City News Day by Agnet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, at last month's National Crop Insurance Conference, Agnet West Gary Cooper talked with United Fresh Produce Association's Robert Gunther about crop insurance and farm bill issues as new policy is being discussed in Washington.
Hi, Robert Gunther. I'm the Senior Vice President of Public Policy for United Fresh Produce Association.
Based out of Washington, D.C. and representing the fresh produce industry around the country, big issues for our listeners both in the Southeast and in California. First of all, we're here at the Crop Insurance Meeting in Scottsdale, Arizona, the annual Crop Insurance Convention. Obviously, we're going into a farm bill, but let's start with crop insurance since we're here at the meeting. What's on your mind about that?
Well, I think, you know, for our perspective, our members, it's a diverse opinions on crop insurance. I mean, for the most part, people, I think in our world, really, you know, want to make sure that there's not any significant impact on the availability of crop insurance. And where they can be enhanced, they'd like to see that. And that's usually through the Farm Bill process, which is what we were talking about today here at this conference. I think that in terms of specifics on crop insurance, I would say first and foremost, one of the priorities for us is looking of ways to expand the utilization of crop insurance and things like food safety and quarantine riders on the current policies. So what we're seeing over the vast majority of fruits and vegetables, those issues are having a significant impact. When you have an outbreak or a quarantine of a commodity, and you may not be even part of that quarantine or commodity, it impacts price, it impacts availability, it impacts a lot beyond just the quarantine or where the food safety outbreak or who's implicated in a food safety outbreak in terms of growers who are impacted. So how can crop insurance help protect at some level those areas where we have those types of situations. And we had a report done in 2014 Farm Bill. It gave back some pretty good results in terms of availability. But we need to expand the risk management tools for specialty crops and fruits and vegetables in particular. Also, I want to, you know, the other areas is citrus in Florida, for instance. When the hurricane came through, crop insurance had mixed results for growers. Some of that had to do with the type of policies they had. So how can we get some lessons learned from that environment to potentially utilize the Farm Bill in helping change or helping enhance for, crop insurance protection when situations like that occur, you know, disasters significantly like that occur?
You know, we've seen, touching on a couple of those points, the citrus folks, gosh, they've been hit with such increased cost on the input side.
Right.
It's like a struggle, and then their production's way down, obviously, as a result of the greening or HLB situation. So it's like, what can I give up or what can I cut back? And I think that kind of caught them in the middle, just trying to pinch pennies to get through the squeeze.
Exactly. I mean, I think certainly that is, you know, a significant component when they had basically just cat insurance, and that was not going to certainly address things when you have such a major disaster like the hurricanes that came through in such a bad time too. I mean, we knew we were really close to harvest time, and it just was the worst case scenario, so to speak, in terms of having that come through.
And when you look at the diversity of these other vegetable crops, there's so many diverse crops out there, and only a handful of the major ones have their own policy.
Right.
They came out with this multi-crop thing, but it seems like from the feedback we get at the grassroots, there's just a lot of complexities to that, the time involved in it, the complexity of the policy. And then if you do have a claim to pay back, it takes so long, they say, to get the money back for the next crop cycle.
And again, that's kind of the uniqueness of our industry when it relates to risk management tools like crop insurance. You know, what a crop insurance product looks like for a tomato grower in Florida is totally different than what it might look like in California. You know, when you look at the major commodities, you know, I mean, a wheat policy is a wheat policy for the most part, or a cotton policy is a cotton policy. You know, it's different in our world, and that makes it unique. And in the time invested from the companies to develop those types of policies is costly. And the return not only to the growers, which is the most important part about this, but the return and investment from the crop insurance companies who are trying to develop these tools to help. It's a tough environment. You're right. You see that all the time, because that's when, you know, in terms of the row crops and fruit and vegetables, you know, you don't see as a broad range of policies out there. You know, where we've had the most success is in permanent crops, quite frankly, because that's a 20-25 year investment. So the apple industry is very pleased with the citrus in most cases, you know, or they've got good tools potentially there. The grape industry, you know, folks like that, they do have the tools available to them. In terms of risk management and crop insurance policies. But in the row crops, it's a totally different environment out there.
Changing gears a little bit, we hear a lot about market access programs these days, a lot of concern about trade, obviously, things coming and going, and some of the trade deals at risk, and this kind of thing helps one industry in one part of the country, part of agriculture, throws another part of the industry under the bus in another part of the country.
Sure.
How's market access program stand in a tight budget year and farm bill negotiations? You think there's a chance to increase it?
If it was any other year, I would say yes. I think it's a tough budget environment, but I think they've made a very compelling case that we have not increased market access program in many years, in several farm bills now. And, you know, the importance of trade, especially for this administration and this Congress, to getting more exports out there, this is a very valuable tool. And I think the MAP coalition, the MAP participants have made a very compelling case. But I don't know if the budget challenges outweigh that. You know, that's the real unfortunate thing about this is there are so many stresses out there of needs. I mean, you heard it today. I mean, just the dairy and cotton industry, not only on, you know, the needs they need, that may cause potential new revenues and if they can't get it fixed before that. But again, I talked about some of the programs that expire at the end of this year or into this fiscal year that were budgeted for in 2014 Farm Bill, $3 billion that are now would go down to zero if they don't find just $3 billion off the top of the board just to get us back to where we were when the Farm Bill was passed in 2014.
You know, we mentioned citrus a couple of minutes ago in terms of the crop insurance ideas, but, you know, on the citrus side, the $25 million a year, I think it was, for 5 years, that expires this year. My, how time flies. It does expire this year. Again, tight budget year, as you just mentioned. But yet, before Irma came along and paid her visit through the citrus belt of Florida, the early estimates were we're going to turn the tide and be the first year in 12 since HLB got discovered that we were actually going to have an increase in the crop, which kind of indicated we were learning learning to live with it better, and the science was working as we were learning, even though we hadn't found the cure quite yet. We were starting to turn that tide, and then along came Irby and blew it all open. So obviously the research has made progress. What do you think the chances are? Again, the same kind of issue. They need that to continue if we're going to get to the end of this thing.
Yeah, I think all this is a challenge because, you know, the program that was developed in the 2014 Farm Bill, the $25 million a year, as you mentioned, expires at the end of this Farm Bill. So the question is, and it's really contained in the what's called a Switch Cart Research Initiative. So the challenge right now is, does that program continue as status quo, or can we find additional money outside of the Switch Cart Research Initiative to continue that same program? Because it has seen success in terms of the investment of research money related to that. There is progress being made. And when you look at potentially, you know, the spread of into Texas and California in particular, I mean, I think that's a very scary situation, and we need to really make sure we have the resources and the government invest the resources to protect that industry, but also, you know, make sure it stays alive because it is the lifeblood, especially in Florida, of the fruit and vegetable industry in Florida.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now. With no real relief in sight regarding agriculture labor issues and the possibility they could get worse with the recent reform talk, California Strawberry Commission's Carolyn O'Donnell said they continue to focus on automation.
The board of directors did set that as a strategic priority a few years ago, and so we've been looking at different avenues of trying to find ways to automate strawberries. It's a very labor-intensive crop. It's hand-planted, hand-harvested, hand-packed, hand-weeded. And, you know, when you're dealing with a crop that keeps continuously producing fruit and you don't really want to destroy the plant or damage the plant, and you need somebody who can distinguish a ripe berry from an almost ripe berry to not very ripe berry and be able to come back week after week to be able to distinguish those, we've really found that human beings are the best judge and the best handlers of those things. We held an automation summit in early January at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and we invited everyone that was working on either harvest machines or harvest assistants or automatic planters or other kinds of automated processes for strawberries. And there was a lot of excitement there. There were a number of people there going, wow, we didn't know so much was going on. We need to get going on our game here. And while we think it's still several years out before we actually see machines that are doing a good job of mechanical harvesting, there's definitely advances being made.
It's unfortunate that one of the more labor-intensive crops is also one of the more challenging to find automation technologies for, and O'Donnell said especially practical ones for California production.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, we do see some, in other countries, we do see some automation related to strawberries that are grown on tabletop or trellises or some kind of artificial construction inside a building. But, you know, the California coast is one of the best places in the world to grow strawberries as far as soil and climate. So it's, you know, you want to take advantages of those natural attributes and then figure out how to automate the rest.
USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service has launched a new electronic data platform to deliver current market price information. The program is called MARS.
Well, it's definitely not a red planet.
That was AMS's Joe Gaynor, who says MARS is an acronym for Market Analysis and Reporting Services.
The bulk of what we do is we have a reporting staff of about 150 federal employees and another 100 state cooperators that they work with industry contacts, industry cooperators, and we collect first level information from them for our reports.
This includes a wide range of information that is related to all aspects of the marketing chain, from producers to consumers.
We cover about 62 different kinds of markets. We call them market types in MARS. In those 62 markets, we cover above 3,000 commodities.
Gaynor pointed to a memory from his childhood to illustrate why this kind of information is needed.
When I was growing up as a kid, I used to go to an auction with my uncle to buy cows, and he always wondered why the guy in the front that's set on a cell phone is buying cows or is deciding not to buy cows. And he always was at basically an information disadvantage.
This new commodity price data platform aims to help address this information disadvantage.
To be able to provide a product that he can use it, or somebody that's doing the same kinds of things, you know, selling vegetables at the farmer's market, they have some information. And I think that's really where market news fills a gap.
MARS provides data that is useful and current because it is largely updated daily or weekly.
There are other agencies that are actually kind of task with looking backwards and looking forwards. And so market news, we fill that gap of covering the stuff that happens today and happens this week. So we're looking for current information for producers and consumers to make buying decisions.
He mentions four commodity categories that will be included: dairy, cotton, livestock, poultry, and grain, and specialty crops.
And right now it's filled with dairy information, but over the next year we're going to continue to migrate the rest of our commodities into there.
The online address is mymarketnews.ams.usda.gov. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on topics you've heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German @BrianAgNetWest and Taylor Hillman @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.